to continue, but we're going to have open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5508. We have a gentleman here this morning that can testify and can't be here tomorrow. Don, would you come on up, please?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. It's my understanding you're reviewing a number of fee increases that have been adopted by the Building Codes Division. Just by way of background, those fee increases had already been put before the industry. The industry members have reviewed the fee increases and supported them. We believe the fee increases are necessary due to the reduction in our volume. The program's an entirely fee-supported program, as you know, and our volume is down about 40% last year, and so consequently there's much reduced fees to operate our programs. So the fee increases were necessary to keep the industry viable, the inspection programs viable. And just as they go up, we hope that they'll go down when the industry is in a recovery mode, and the experience with the agency is that they are willing to reduce fees. And that concludes my remarks.
Don, any questions?
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Don, I know that your industry is struggling right now. What does this do if John Q. Public wants to buy a manufactured home and place it on a lot?
Mm-hmm.
What does this do to the price of doing that?
Oh, it's spread out through the fee increase takes effect in a variety of places. The manufacturer pays $10 more per section, so a double section home would cause the cost to go up about $20. Installation inspections, if the state performs them, would go up also. The visual inspection goes up from 95 to 125, I think.
Maybe you haven't costed it out. I just wonder what it would cost somebody who...
It's probably $100 or less. Probably much less on a house.
Question, Madam Chair.
President Butler.
Thank you. Don, on the single visual inspection, you made the comment that the cost, if the state does the work, are these not also passed through so that local programs within the counties or cities that have their own program that they can adopt these same fees?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that they can also exceed these fees, and many of them do exceed the state fees. My guess is probably most local governments charge more than the state of Oregon charges, even with these fee increases.
Well, this is just the state fee, not any. It has no bearing on the local. Local fees can go up as local governments would deem necessary to enhance their programs?
That's correct.
All right, thank you very much.
Senator Duke?
If you've had a 40% drop in sales, do we need the same number of FTE?
I believe that the FTE have been cut back in the program.
Thank you very
much. We're hoping to salvage a skeleton so we can operate. There's just, whether a factory is operating at full capacity or at half capacity, there still needs to be an inspector.
Oh, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Miner, I'm sorry to beat this to death, but I'm just looking at this whole menu of fees, and if I understood your response to Senator Duke's question, she asked if someone wants to place a manufactured home on a site, what would be the effect of that of these fee increases on that siting, and you said $100 or less. I'm looking at this whole menu and seeing some additional inspection at the time of manufacture fees. Do those get passed on to the consumers? So beyond just the citing of $100 or less, are there more consumer impacts that are passed on through the manufacturing process inspections?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe that would be the combined effect. All of the fees get passed on.
Okay, but just to make sure I understand this, if I decide I want to place a home on a site I have, I'm looking at less than $100 total increases to me as a result of these fee increases. I probably shouldn't have used me as an example.
Senator
Dukes wants to do it.
I believe that's true. Many of these fees deal with homes that are out there in the field. The consumer wants the home to be inspected, see if there's something wrong. These are existing homes. Those fees are in here as well.
Okay.
But installation, that's my understanding.
I'm satisfied. I'm not questioning your veracity. I'm just questioning my understanding, and I just want to make sure that when the call comes from someone who suddenly now is worried about increases in inspection fees, I can say with absolute clarity that I spoke to the manufacturer's representatives, and this is, in fact, what the effect is. And that's all I'm trying to understand before I put my hand up.
And I believe that's true.
Thank you.
I'd identify by name.
Pardon? Identify me by name and my home phone number?
Yeah, I've got his card. I'll pass.
Actually, I believe these fees are already in effect. That may be a typographical error saying they go into effect in 10:01. I believe they're in effect now, so you should have had those calls already.
And we already had that discussion with the so we just need to approve them.
Thank you very much.
And with that, we'll put the public hearing on Senate Bill 5508, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 5507. Robin, just continue with your walking through your recommendations.
Madam Chair, members, let me get a feel for the committee before I move on. Is there consensus that the recommendations on the Workers' Compensation Board are acceptable? Because if so, we could dispose of that matter and then move on.
Is there any concern about that, Representative Butler?
Madam Chair, we are in work session, and we do have a quorum. If there is consensus, I would move the Workers' Compensation Board recommendation, both as to the LFO current service recommendation and as to the all funds type, at $16,187,683.97.5 FTE.
I believe, Madam Chair, he is referring to the current service level, or?
I'm sorry. I should have jumped all the way through, all the way to the, the $16,187,000 is with the 1% reduction.
Right.
16,187,683.
Yes.
That is the current service level as adjusted with the LFO policy outcome package number 1 and 97.5.
We've heard the motion by Representative Butler. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Great.
Robin?
Okay. Moving on to Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That's on page 2 of the memo, item number 3. The recommendation is to approve the revised current service level of $36,852,276 other funds and 236 positions and 235.08 FTE. That is on page 6 of my spreadsheet. This includes a reduction of $250,195 for PERS and standard assessment reductions. This is in the base. And a reduction of $2,287,850 and 17 positions at FTE in package 090. That is a personnel services and supplies and travel reductions that we have discussed related to the shortfall in assessment revenue for that program. Also approve a reduction of $1,087 about to take away half their budget. $1,087 in out of state travel. And with that, we are recommending approval of a budget of $36,851,189 other funds and 236 positions and 235.8 FTE.
Discussion. Representative Gardner.
I just had a couple of questions, Madam Chair. You're talking about 235 FTE. Do you have could you direct me toward the breakdown where the between management and line workers on the FTE?
That would be in the, I'm not sure that specific breakdown is in the presentation material, but if you go to the Oregon OSHA section on page 46 of the presentation material, and also the handout that was given to us yesterday.
I thought I'd seen this before. I apologize for not being here yesterday, but the non-supervisory management, I just had some questions about what on earth is a non-supervisory management?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there was testimony yesterday. The department has a number of... Go ahead, Debbie.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I think Robin was probably fine on this. Those are people who have a what's called a community of interest with managers. They are staff rather than line people. They include, well, across the department, they include people like actuaries, the internal auditor, one or two policy people. In OSHA, I would say they would be Pete, non-supervisory manager in OSHA would be the assistant to Pete, for example, an administrative assistant to other managers who, for personnel and privacy reasons, need to be in management.
We have two kinds. One is...
Yeah, probably come on up, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, Pete DeLuca, Administrator of Oregon OSHA. We have two kinds of non-supervisory excluded employees, and these are as provided for by the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. There are two positions, if I'm not mistaken, in my office who work directly with me, process my paperwork. If there were grievances, they would come through those people. Do confidential type correspondence and other correspondence as well. And then there are two others who are in positions which we sent to the Department of Administrative Services for a look, and it was determined that they have a community of interest with management. Those people, one of them is responsible for doing our strategic planning and for working with the federal government on our grants, and the other one is responsible for doing internal auditing.
If I might, Madam Chair, if someone who processes paperwork and processes claims sounds awful secretarial to me, what's the community of interest with management?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, of course, we have a lot of people who process paperwork and process claims, and those do not have a community of interest with management. The ones that do are the people who are involved directly in my office in discussions with me and with my staff in terms of, particularly in terms of collective bargaining.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I think you'll find across state agencies that people at that level, the directors, deputy directors, administrators, all their assistants are in management service because they see very confidential personnel information is the biggest reason. Grievances that come to me go through my assistant, and if that person were part of the union, those kinds of things couldn't come through her. So every director, every administrator in state government has an assistant who's in management service.
But when a grievance comes through you, what does your, I mean, you deal generally with the grievance, not the assistant.
Senator Clarno, Representative Gardner, yes, but my assistant sorts the mail, it comes to her, and she has access to all my files, so my files are confidential. She has to have, she is a confidential employee. She's got that kind of clearance.
It's interesting. Madam Chair, just for the record, perhaps I shouldn't, but for today, seeing as I have not had enough time to go through this, I have not been through the charts of these types of employees, have not been through the documentation, and feel uncomfortable voting a yes today for many of these reasons.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. We'll just have more discussion on this issue right now, and then we'll move on to one we can get agreement.
Madam Chair, I might as well throw my piece out. I finally found the one that's been bothering me from the beginning. And I don't.
What page are you on, Senator?
Well, I'm in the book.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure. I have to this handout, how to make these two come together, but it's the it's part of the their reduction option and eliminates four consultant positions in a federal grant match program. The feds are giving us 85% of the money, and which we will lose if we cut these four consultants. And it's going to save us a whole $31,000.
Madam Chair, members, it's on page 51 of the reduction option.
And it's going to save us $31,000 in general fund.
A lot of weeks I don't make that much.
But I can find that real easy for you in here. We're going to go ahead for the out-of-state professional travel, and we can pick up the $31,000. This has never made any sense to me, this one.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, we're expecting this one. And there is a good reason. And all right, let me give this to you. Mike Rogers yesterday, when he testified, gave you an earlier version of this, and we did work with the union to some extent to be sure we were absolutely accurate. The problem with that grant is that it's more trouble than it's worth. There are huge administrative costs that aren't shown in the $31,000 of direct match to that federal grant that make this a very difficult grant to manage. We have to have two separate computer systems, because the federal government requires that we use its computer system and the rest of our program uses another computer system. There's a huge amount of reporting to be done. These folks have restrictions on them in terms of which kind of businesses they can go into and how they deal with these businesses that make the consultation much longer, much more problematic. These consultants can, if they see a hazard, turn that business into enforcement and send enforcement out. If you'll recall, Pete talked about the firewall between consultation and enforcement, where the state consultants cannot turn around and turn somebody into enforcement if they see something. They simply work with the business. But the federal consultants not only can, but under federal requirements should. So we prepared a handout here on the differences between what those four people can do versus what the other 38 consultants can do. I will point out that we have more consultants than any other state in the country, and we think that by not accepting this particular federal grant, we can make our whole program a lot more efficient and eliminate that overhead that is so costly and time-consuming and confusing to businesses and to labor.
Yes, Madam Chair, to just put it in the vernacular of the folks that I work with on a daily basis out in the farming and ranching community, if the federal government gives you $10 to have a boil on your bum, you're not going to pay another $2 just to keep it there.
I think that's a very interesting analogy, one I've not heard before.
Where's it from the heartland?
Senator Dukes.
Be that as it may. I was here in the days when OROSHA came under heavy attack from employers because if an inspector got anywhere near your place, you had tickets written. And I had all kinds of employers complaining to me that that half the tickets didn't make any sense, that they, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had let them know what some of these regulations were before we decided to cite them for it. And the agency has worked really hard to overcome that, and one of the things we did was to beef up the consultants and send them out. Now, in the last year, these four people, how many times have they cited while they were out consulting?
Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, I don't have that right now. They don't cite themselves. But they can send out an enforcement officer if they see something hazardous. I don't believe that they have done that.
That was my guess, too.
Yeah, but they can do that, and the federal government does look at that very carefully.
And I guess if they were doing it, I'd be more sympathetic. I'm real nervous about losing four consultants who are out there trying to help businesses comply. Because this route, we get a lot better compliance from businesses than we do or ever did the enforcement route.
Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, we absolutely agree. Our proposal is to cut 6 enforcement officers and 6 consultants, and we would rather not cut anybody because every one of those people assist businesses. We're simply
got the computer system, I assume, up and running. It may be a different computer system, but you've already got it.
It requires double entry, manual reconciliation, and the feds are looking at a new computer system that'll make us start all over again.
But I assume that the people who are doing the double entry are the four folks that consultants.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, no, not necessarily. They're support people, administrative people.
What we'll do is, unless Ellipa has any more information for us on this package, we will wait till midweek next week and revisit this to see if folks in that will give Representative Gardner more opportunity to review what his concerns are. I respect the fact that you're in leadership and lots of times you have meetings, so we'll do this, revisit this next week. Representative Butler, did you have anything further?
I did, Madam Chair. Just one item, two items, actually. Ms. Lincoln has brought up one that I would like to follow up on, but I would like Oregon Revised Statute 705.145, that's the point to discuss the results of the fiscal breakdown, and I would like to have the fiscal breakdown by department. There's a rather complex accounting that's required there, showing pluses and minuses, and any projection that you might have, if I could have that for the past two biennia, and any projection. I understand that we are projecting, according to Mr. Kruger, as much as 70,000 negative in one particular program during this next biennium. So I would like to have the benefit of that projection as well as the required information under 705.145. And then the second issue was that we have quite a number of OSHA inspectors in the state of Oregon. I would like to know how many inspectors we have in relationship to other states. If we could have that information, that would be, I think, pretty good information to have.
Well, Madam Chair, I've heard more straight talk from Representative Butler and Debbie Lincoln in the last 5 minutes than I've heard in the last 8 years in the legislature, I think. I really appreciate laying it right out there. I a little more wisdom from the Hartman, Madam Chair. My position on this has been, if you have a bunch of people working on a green chain and they're getting carpal tunnel, and OSHA comes in and modifies the workstation so that they can do the job safely, that's great. If the mill closes, the workers go away, which they have. And then we don't need the inspector anymore either. Now, I don't want to see these people put out of a living. That seems to me, by transfer or something, there should be other jobs available for them. But if we don't need them to inspect the green chain anymore, then the job, the position should be eliminated. The people themselves, there should be some way of taking care of them.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. Okay, LFO, we're going to go on next to Insurance Division. Madam Chair and Lori will cover that.
I'll talk very loudly. Project my voice. Chair Carno, members of the subcommittee, if you'll turn to the memo, item number 4, Insurance Division. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approving the revised current service level of $14,685,399 other funds, 94 positions, and 93.21 full-time equivalent positions. The detail is on page 8 of the spreadsheet that's attached. This current service level calculation includes a reduction of $98,611 for PERS and other standard assessment rate reductions.
Madam Chair, we are in work session and we do have the required quorum. I would move the Legislative Fiscal Office's recommendation relative to the Insurance Division at the current service level of
$14,685,399.93.21 FTE.
Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. The next recommendation from LFO is to approve policy option package 141, senior health insurance benefits program, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, life and health. These are two positions that total $248,678, other funds. If you want the detail on that position to review, it's on page 51 in your presentation handbook. Nope. Actually, I gave you the wrong page number. Page 61.
I'd move package 141 is in accordance with the recommendation of the LFO.
Any discussion on Representative Butler's motion? Any objection? Not so moved.
The next recommendation is to approve a reduction of $2,222, which is a 1% reduction for out-of-state travel.
Representative Johnson?
I didn't want to interrupt Representative Butler's role, but I would approve the LFO recommendation of a reduction of $2,222 in out-of-state travel.
You big spender.
Representative Johnson's motion. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, tell me one and no why it's only 1%.
Well, looking at this amount, I think I should have probably said we'd do more, but we'll start.
When we get back to that $31,000, we can
objections?
Revisit that.
Any objections? Just more.
No. Yeah.
It's not.
No,
so, we'll move.
So, with all these recommendations as approved, that brings the division's budget to a total of $14,931,855 other funds, 96 positions, and 95.21 full-time equivalent positions for the whole division, and the detail for that is on page 8, if you'd like to go there.
President Johnson.
Madam Chair, I would move approval of the LFO recommendation at $14,931,855 other funds, 96 positions, 95.21 FTE for the insurance.
We've all heard Representative Johnson's motion. Any discussion? Any objections? Not so moved.
I believe the last item on our handout is probably going to be deferred.
Yes,
I think
deferred.
We're prepared to do a work session on that. Either at this time. So we're complete with our recommendation.
Okay, I'll move the work session on Senate Bill 5507 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5507.
Division of Finance and Corporate Security.
I'm sure I took a deep breath and was about to leave. pleased to start with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and here to present that budget is Greg Malkasian, currently Deputy Administrator, soon to be Acting Administrator of the Division.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Malkasian, the Deputy Administrator of the Division. Today I'd like to cover various areas within the documentation that's provided you on the tab Finance and Corporate Securities, starting on page 64. That particular page is our organization chart. Now, kind of start over from the right and move over. The first two columns from the far right cover three-quarters of the personnel within our organization, and these are involved in three major programs: banking, credit union, and securities. In the banking and credit union areas, our interest, our focus is to assure safety and soundness of the institutions, and we accomplish that through chartering and examining these financial institutions. In the securities, that middle column there, our focus is on consumer protection. We accomplish that by registering securities, licensing entities, and we also test and license individuals who sell securities. Effectively, we conduct examinations of these licensees. We investigate and prosecute people who violate the securities law, and promote an informed public through our investor education program. We have one FTE in that. Over on the far left is our non-depository program, and you heard from Jim Kruger. He's the program manager of that program, and here we have one quarter of our staff that are combined into the program that oversee 9 different programs. Those programs are, I'll break them out into the function that we serve. One is to license and register, and in that area, in that function, we license or register mortgage lenders, consumer finance companies, pawnbrokers that you heard about, debt consolidation agencies, collection agencies, credit services organizations, certificate authorities that might be better understood as electronic signatures, and money transmitters. And then we also finally certify associations of sellers of travel. In addition to licensing and registering these various activities in the non-depository program, we conduct examinations on many of the companies. We respond to complaints and conduct investigations in all of those program areas. To give you an example, for instance, in the mortgage lender area, we had a complaint that consumers felt that they had entered into fixed-rate mortgages when actually those mortgages turned out to be adjustable-rate mortgages with a balloon payment. In this particular matter, there were 42 consumers that ultimately shared in portions of $150,000 paid by the mortgage lender in a stipulated settlement as an outcome of that particular case. So our focus was consumer protection. In another matter in the area of consumer finance companies, last year we conducted 101 consumer finance exams, and through the course of those exams we identified errors or what we call exceptions that resulted in $263,000 refunded to consumers. Some examples of the types of errors that we found were in errors in calculating the annual percentage rate. The focus here is disclosure, so that the consumer knows exactly what they're getting into. There were errors in calculating that rate, and there were some failures to properly disclose prepayment penalties, and if those disclosures are not complete enough, those penalties are not allowed by the finance company and they're refunded to the consumer. On the next page, we have several areas, and the focus here is on the purpose and the mission and the goals, and I think that's best summarized by our mission. And I'm going to read that to be very succinct and clear, that our mission is to encourage the widest possible range of financial services, products, and information for Oregonians provided in a safe, sound, and fraud-free manner. And I want to emphasize that in doing so, we strive to promote a positive business climate in those industries that we regulate. I'll move over to some of the successes on the next page and give you a few examples. During this past biennium, we were able to provide more timely program information to our customers through use of the Internet. In 1997, that was the last year we produced a hard copy annual report of our division activities. In the mid-1990s, we were distributing almost 1,500 of these hard copy reports. Now we provide that information on our website more quickly and efficiently. Certainly when you're doing a hard copy report, you have to wait for all the information to come in before you can complete it. When pieces of the information come in piecemeal, we can provide that on our website as the information is available and updated. We have added several things to our website as well. Most of greatest interest to us and encouragement from our stakeholders was providing many of the forms that are required on the Internet for easy accessibility and complying with our regulations. Another area, early in the biennium, I'm sure many of you were concerned about the year 2000 concern and the transition to the year 2000 by our banking and other financial institutions. our examiners work very closely with federal banking officials, the bankers, and the banks and the credit unions that we regulate to assure a successful transition to the year 2000. And we did enjoy a successful transition on January 1, 2000. In the next biennium, Joel Ariel spoke to you about the Graham Leach-Bliley Act yesterday in his testimony, and we're partnering with them naturally because this act essentially removes all the regulatory barriers among the financial service providers and permits those providers to simultaneously provide varying financial services in the area of insurance, securities, and financial services. It established financial holding companies, and bottom line, as was mentioned by your committee, there was federal laws that were enacted, and we're still going through a phase of rulemaking and also interpretations related to that act that we're working very closely with the insurance division, and will continue to do so to ensure an appropriate level of service to those that we regulate. As an aside, it might be helpful to know that banks in Oregon have had authority to sell insurance since 1987. Now banks can own insurance companies and securities firms and vice versa. Let me move over to some of our outcome measures to give you an idea on page 68 what we see are some key issues. One of our key issues is to assure that we provide value-added regulation in a federal-state dual jurisdictional environment in the banking area. We work closely with federal bank and credit union regulators to achieve this, and in the last 2 years, we have adopted an automated examination software and conduct these examinations using laptop computers. This has provided our examinations with a higher quality, a faster delivery of feedback to the institution that we're regulating, and to assure that this is done very smoothly in a dual jurisdictional environment, our examiners receive the same training as the federal bank and credit union examiners. These computers allow us to download the data when we get back to the office and provide faster turnaround to those institutions. In addition, in another area, we work very closely from a regulatory perspective with federal securities activities, our federal counterparts in the Securities and Exchange Commission, the National Association of Security Dealers, and various law enforcement agencies. Another key issue is to ensure that each dedicated program is self-supporting with the flexibility to cover program costs. And Senate Bill 305 is our substantive regulation that we are trying to achieve that, and that bill enjoyed a 29-0 vote of confidence in the Senate and is now on the House side. And I guess we'll move into Satish's portion for the option packages.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, I would like to tell you how the governor's budget was developed. The starting point was the 9901 legislative adopted budget, and I'm on page 69. The legislative adopted budget was $8.1 million total funds. There was one emergency board action. This dealt with employee compensation cost increases. This is an increase of $230,959. Then there were two base budget adjustments related to personal services costs. And with that increases, we have the base budget of $9.2 million total funds. Under package 010, you'll see that there's a decrease to adjust for vacancy factor savings. That's a decrease of $50,452. The next item, the non-personal information control systems adjustment, that is for mass transit taxes, and that's $6,718. Under package 020, you'll see program adjustments of $6,554. That is the phase-in cost for two positions that were approved by the 99 legislature. and these are services and supplies costs associated with those with the positions approved as a result of the approval of those packages. Under package 030, you will see the standard inflation increases and cost of state government service charges. So with that, we have a current service level budget of $9,367,174 total funds. There are two policy packages, and I'll have the department talk to you about those two packages.
Thank you, Satish. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Greg Malkasian again. As Satish indicated, we do have two option packages. The first one is package 161. It's for a senior policy analyst. This establishes a new position. In addition to acting as a legislative coordinator and hearings officer for rulemaking and non-contested cases for a division, the incumbent in this position will advise the director, the legislature, and the governor's office on public policy and regulatory issues in the many programs, the 13 programs that I talked about, that we regulate. Specifically, one of the areas of focus is certainly the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act that we've talked about. It creates a need for us to examine all of our laws and coordinate with other agencies, and we will continue to be extensively involved in that transition. And the senior policy analyst is our chief person involved in this effort. Also, this position will work with program managers of the 13 programs on legislation, rules and legal issues, and that's a very time-consuming task. This position allows adequate attention to be given to these important policy functions. This change has been implemented on a limited duration basis during the biennium and is working well. Extensive time was spent on high-profile issues that were even touched on today, the pawnbroker versus buy-sell shops issue, and payday and title loan lenders loans that you may have heard about as well. Two public hearings were held on payday and title loans, and rules were adopted after extensive testimony, and this person was the primary focus in those efforts. On option package 162.
Where did you get $161,000 in funding for a limited duration position?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, the money was it was a limited duration position for a portion of the biennium, and we received some of that funding by cutting costs within the organization. This was, I believe, adopted in the about the May-July time frame, and then some other was provided through limitation that was available through the agency. And it wasn't that amount. This funding request is for the next biennium, which would be a full 24 months. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Option package 162 requests two positions. One is a financial examiner position to allow better oversight of the rapidly changing mortgage lender industry and identify abusive and predatory lending practices within the industry. I spoke earlier in my testimony of one example of a mortgage lender case, but some of the primary issues and practices that we want to make sure in our effort to have consumer protection is awareness, and awareness of hidden balloon payments and early payment penalties in the contracts that consumers sign. And we don't want them to be unaware or unprepared for these situations. And this industry has grown significantly. During the period 95 to 99, we've seen a growth of, in combined individual licensees and offices, a 300% increase in these activities from just about 900 to over 3,600 entities that we regulate. It's recently taken a downturn in the numbers because it's volatile with respect to the economy, but there's considerable movement of licensees and offices within this number that I talked about. And we've also experienced cyclical fluctuations in the past. Given the recent drop in interest rates, we expect that there's a potential of a resurgence of refinancing, as well as a potential of new home buyers that should generate additional persons entering the business. Our interest here, and certainly the support we received from those that we regulated, has been to be able to get out and conduct examinations of these activities to ensure compliance. The second position in this package is a consumer education specialist. And our interest here is to provide information on how the mortgage industry works and how to identify and avoid lenders who engage in what is commonly known as predatory lending practices. This will be a similar approach to a successful program we have in our securities section, our investor information program. This program has reached thousands of Oregonians through radio, television, public service announcements, handing out brochures, and also getting contact with people, groups, and even at fairs to provide information related to prudent investing. The industry is aware of this public concern over predatory lending, and they've been very supportive of these positions. We believe that an informed public is better able to avoid being caught in a predatory lending situation. It's a proactive action on the part of safeguarding the consumer and consumer protection. And for the same reason, the industry has supported this as well. That concludes the discussion of the option packages, and I'd like to try and answer any questions.
Representative Butler.
I noticed that amongst the activities that your consumer education specialist is involved in addition to predatory lending practices and identification as to who might be involved in those, the position also provides consumer information on other division programs, including consumer finance lending, debt consolidation services, and pawnbroker activities. We just talked briefly about pawnbrokers just a few minutes ago. Is a portion of this position being charged to the pawnbrokers?
Madam Chair, Senator Farno, the way we approach apportionment of cost is actually an analysis of the effort by the full-time equivalency, the position, in participating in those various different program areas.
The answer is they would be cost apportioned.
Yes, sir, if it's significant enough to warrant cost apportionment. We believe that the type of information that we would provide would really be a lead person type relationship where if we identify and we provide information, we can redirect questions or concerns to the people in that program. They're the people that are out there connecting, the first line folks, Representative Butler, that are out meeting the public, and we want to make sure that all the services that we offer at the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities are available to the public.
Just follow up, Madam Chair, the comment is, if it's significant enough that it would be cost apportioned, that this cost would be cost apportioned, I would say that it must have been significant enough, or you wouldn't have written it down here amongst the three activities that this person would be doing. So I would say that, again, we'll see what the Oregon Revised Statutes provide and how cost apportionment is going on, but I would think that with regard to most all of the positions that you share in the department, there must be some sort of cost apportionment. Are you doing some cost apportionment right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I think your assessment is exactly right, and we do that. Jim had indicated earlier that we have 0.6 FTE, and it's 0.2 people and 0.3 each. We get right down to 0.08 FTE. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a very interesting thing about the subprime loans, and if more staff would identify and save consumers significant amounts of money, that would be a worthwhile investment. Having someone to oversee 38 pawnbrokers doesn't strike me as a wise use of of funds, nor does recovering $145,000 spreading among 45 mortgagees seem like a very big recovery. Would adding these three positions add significantly to consumer protection?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the dollar amounts and the were that I shared with you on that allocation was just one particular case as an example. I believe that the focus of this policy package is proactive from the perspective of having an information specialist out in the field to inform people that are about to make probably one of the most significant contractual obligations that they'll ever be involved in, make them aware of what to look for and safeguard them so that we're dealing with it on the front end rather than a complaint on the other end. The other side of it is that right now, while we are trying to achieve regular visits to the various industries that we or mortgage lenders that we regulate, we're really trying to stay on top of just responding to concerns or problems that we've identified in the industry. And so having this other position, we hope to make regular visits so that we can assist these licensees in complying with the regulations and therefore result in exactly what you had indicated, consumer protection.
Dukes. I'm only one member of the committee, so I don't know that it makes a whole lot of difference here. But if you're counting on me on package 1621, it's probably not going to get too far, so just for whatever that's worth. I don't know when I've seen 38 businesses get as much attention as those four bond brokers are getting today. On 162, the second position that you identify here, predatory lending practices and trying to help people identify and avoid them. Aren't most of the folks who end up dealing with lenders like that pretty desperate anyway?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe you're correct. There's a certain amount of desperateness, but I think in this area, likely not. And in the mortgage lending area, we're talking about people that are entering into contracts for mortgage loans. And so they're qualifying for a mortgage loan. And some of the the reason why we call them predatory is because the nature of the contract and the development of the contract, and if you've ever signed one of those, I've signed a few and I've never read every page, and some of these aspects of the balloon payments and the adjustable rate mortgage rather than what you assume by talking to the lender as a fixed mortgage are buried into the contract. And so what we're trying to do in exactly that position that you mentioned is make the consumer aware to look very closely at those specific areas that could be very costly to them in the future.
People tend to call your office before they get a mortgage?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, that is exactly why we want to have an information specialist out there so they know the services that are available, and hopefully they don't even need us because they know the problem areas. Generally, the calls that we receive, I believe, are more of a complaint nature.
But what is this person going to do to make people more aware? I think that most people who sign mortgages don't really understand, and I would have thought that more of this would be related to second mortgages, which seems to be a growing thing in this state.
Madam Chair,
what's this person going to do?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, this person is designed similar to our investor information specialist in the securities area, where we really feel that we have achieved some successes of forewarning people of the problems. And through various activities, David Bernatz, our investor information specialist, even goes out to county fairs and gets out there and talks to folks that are considering the potential of investing. And what we hope to do is make ourselves more available to citizens of Oregon in this particular area of awareness, and then certainly, as Representative Butler indicated, other areas of services that we provide in, within DFCS, to be more of a an approach of solving the problem before it happens, so there is no problem.
I'm assuming that the $267,000 figure is salary and benefits. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Dukes, it, you know, I could get that information for you, but it's, we have a specific worksheet, and it not only shows the salary and the associated other payroll expenses, which include the benefits, but it also anticipates all the in-state travel. It anticipates the cost associated with generating brochures. It also has an initial cost of setting up the positions in the first place.
Could we get a breakdown of that? Because what I was going to ask was, what are the services and supplies and what kind of travel are they getting?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's actually in your binder, and it is on page 160.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, respectfully, the House is convening right now.
Yes, and the Senate's going to convene in about 6 minutes tonight. Mm-hmm. What I would like to share with you is what we're going to do tomorrow. We're going to have the public testimony on the fee bill. Public testimony on the Division of Finance, Corporate Securities, and Building Codes Division, and a public hearing on the building codes. And then tomorrow is Thursday, of course, so on Monday we'll have a work session on Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, building codes possibly, and the first thing I hope on the agenda will be to finalize the PERS budget. And I would ask that the anyone who has not had a chance to visit with Dallas regarding the changes that will be in the PERS budget, and be so that we're ready to go into work session and be comfortable with those changes. Anything further? Thank you for the good work of the committee this morning. See you tomorrow.